everyone. Welcome to the Environmental Law Institute. My name is Alana Harrison, and I'm the Assistant Director of Professional Education here at ELI. Thank you all for joining us for the first of ELI's summer school sessions. The summer series is designed to give you some introduction to the legal and policy foundations of environmental protection in the United States. And I wanted to especially thank DC Bar's Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources section for co-sponsoring this series. So our first session today is an introduction to careers in environmental law and policy. We have a great panel here who come from many different sections and specialities in this field. And this is your opportunity to really ask them as many questions as possible, whether about law school, job searching, or practicing in the field. So please don't be shy. I also have a few logistical notes before we get started. For the audience in the room, if you have a question, we'll be handing out a microphone, and Helen here will be assisting us. So it's here simply to capture the audio, so there's no need to speak directly into it. For those of us who are here online, if you have a question for the panel, please submit it through the GoToWebinars question box. Our full speaker biographies are available online at www.eli.org, and we'll have a recording of this session available online within the next week if you'd like to reference it later on. So I guess just to dive right in, let me briefly introduce our speakers for today. So we have Margaret Bowman, who's a principal with Bowman Environmental Consulting, LLP. We have Joseph Halso, an associate attorney with Sierra Club. We have Leela Jones, a trial attorney with the ENRD, U.S. Department of Justice. We have Linda Tseng, a legislative attorney with the Congressional Research Service at the Library of Congress. We have Peter Whitfield, who's with Hogan Lovells. And then we also have Charles DeLiva, a chief counsel in the Environmental and International Law section of the World Bank. So I thought we could just get started today by having you all introduce yourself, sort of explain how you came into your current position, and give us a little bit of background detail.
Great. I guess I'm starting. Yes. Hi, everyone, and I'm happy to be back here at my alma mater, Environmental Law Institute. I've worked here for about 4 years, way back when, and I ran into a colleague about out in the hall, and they said, oh, you're speaking on the panel, you're speaking about how many jobs you can have in your career, so that's my introduction. I'm also feel a bit of like an imposter here because I actually don't practice law anymore, but I guess I'm here to show that you don't have to practice law when you get out of law school. I work now on as an environmental consultant, focusing on water sustainability in the American West, both consulting with foundations and nonprofit organizations, and also building a nonprofit myself that is working on impact investing and bringing private investors into the water space. Before that, I was working for over 11 years in private foundations, leading programs that were trying to both move water policy change in the American West with the Walton Family Foundation, and before that with the Pew Charitable Trust, working on fishery sustainability. And before that, I worked for about a decade at a nonprofit advocacy organization called American Rivers, where I led advocacy work, actually almost practiced law back then, working on hydropower, dam operation, dam removal, and general water policy. And before that, worked at the Environmental Law Institute, helping law drafting in Central and Eastern Europe as they were evolving from communist states to capitalist states, helping them revise their environmental laws. Before that, I lived in Central and Eastern Europe, doing similar work independently. And before that, I actually practiced law out of law school for a couple of years at a large law firm here in town, practice environmental, general environmental law. So that's me.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. My name is Joe Halso. I'm an attorney at the Sierra Club. And to be perfectly honest, my path has been quite straight. I was telling my colleagues in the lunchroom a moment ago, this is my 456th day as an attorney. And each and every day has been at the Sierra Club. I started as a fellow in March 2015 and was hired to their staff earlier this year. And all that to say, my worldview is very much as the interviewee rather than the interviewer. And so happy to field questions about interview process and pitfalls to avoid. I have a clear memory of the mistakes that I made and remember most of my interview answers still. And so that's knowledge I hope to impart, things like networking in a room when you don't know a single person in it. So what do I do? I work on electric vehicle policy, and my goal is to make it easier for anyone to get into an electric car. I try to leverage the power of electric utilities through their legislative clout, through their access to capital, to initiate programs that support electric vehicles. And so that means I'm sort of equal parts a policy advocate. We look at how utilities should be regulated so that they can further electric vehicle adoption in this country. And a litigator. I work for utility regulatory commissions, which are these strange bodies that are sort of legislative, sort of judicial, and they tell and decide what a utility can spend on infrastructure. And so a utility will come and say, I want to spend this many million dollars on electric vehicle charging stations, and I, as an interested party at Sierra Club, can step in and say, that is wonderful, I can't wait to support you doing it, and let me tell you how I'd like you to do it. And so that's sort of my day-to-day work. The most exciting parts are our litigation. And how I got here, I am a graduate of the University of Michigan Law School. I also attended University of Michigan for undergrad, where I studied English, environmental science, and had a variety of environmentally related jobs, both scientific, worked for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, and more hands-on. I managed Michigan's outdoor trip program for a number of years. I led outdoor trips, worked at summer camps for a long time. So environmental work has always been close to my heart and head. So that's where I come from.
Hello, my name is Leela Jones, and I work for the Environment and Natural Resources Division of the Department of Justice, doing enforcement, civil enforcement, which basically means fines and injunctive relief, kind of making people add filters or build buildings or penalizing them if they've done something wrong. So nobody goes to jail that I deal with. But I have, I'm very new, so less than 400 days of my job. I came into the Department of Justice through the Honors Program, which if that's something you haven't heard of, you should definitely Google it. It's a really neat program. And it's a great way to get into the Department of Justice. And I just started last September, so I am much closer to law school graduation than probably anybody else on this panel. So I might be closer to the audience than everyone else here. And I, before I went to law school, I actually worked in finance for a while. So if anybody has questions about, like, how to, can you have a career and then become a lawyer, and can you transition to two drastically different fields, you absolutely can. And it's very doable. So that's, I guess, yeah, that's probably, yeah, I guess we'll just see the questions we have.
Hi, thanks to ELI for organizing this great panel. My name is Linda Sang, and ELI was very kind because my name plaque should actually say Linda Sang unemployed right now, because I'm transitioning into the Library of Congress starting on Monday as a legislative attorney working on constitutional, environmental, and energy issues, providing non-political, nonpartisan advice to members of Congress and their staff. So that's what I will be doing. That's all I can tell you about, because I haven't started. But I think it's going to be quite exciting. Just a few weeks ago, I was the policy director for climate change and air quality for the American Forest and Paper Association. I was with them for several years, doing exactly what my title has in it, working on issues like the Clean Power Plan, how they affect the pulp and paper and forestry industry, and any greenhouse gas regulations that were coming out of DOE and EPA as well. Prior to that, I was at Beveridge and Diamond, an environmental law firm, for about 5.5 years, doing regulatory compliance, more Clean Air Act stuff, a lot of permitting issues. And like Leela, this is a second career for me. I used to be an environmental engineer working for the Environmental Defense Fund and EPA, doing drinking water and other types of sustainability work. So I can help field any questions about making that transition. It's possible, it's slightly painful, but it's absolutely doable, and it's sort of like getting sort of your head into a different place and going back to school. And I think in this interesting time when you do it mid-career and sort of your focus is very keen because you sort of done certain things for a period of time, and then you're like, okay, and now I want to do something different, and I don't want to waste any more time. And I think that's it's an interesting transition story, and I think it's a good growing opportunity. So I will leave it at that.
Hi, everybody. My name is Peter Whitfield, and I'm at Program Levels. And similar to Linda, I guess I was technically unemployed for the last 3 days, so I just transitioned over from another firm. So everything's still kind of new. But I imagine that I'm going to do a combination of what I did at my previous firm, which is work on a lot of Clean Air Act issues and environmental litigation-related matters for a variety of different clients, as well as what I did at DOJ. So like Leela, I went into the Department of Justice and the Environment and Natural Resources Division through the Honors Program. And I worked in the Natural Resources Section, and that's, I guess our charge was to defend federal agencies against a litany of various different lawsuits brought under primarily the National Environmental Policy Act, but it also involved the Endangered Species Act, the National Historic Preservation Act, loads of natural resource-based laws, as well as Fifth Amendment takings defenses. And then before DOJ, I actually was a law clerk to two different federal judges in federal court in North Carolina. I kind of always knew that I wanted to do environmental law. I did take a very short break between undergrad and law school and worked at the Discovery Channel and thought, maybe I can do environmental-related work by hosting a nature show, and that didn't really work out. So I was like, you know, law school's a good opportunity to be able to do environmental-related stuff without necessarily being a scientist or, you know, somebody who has a very highly technical environmental degree. And that had kind of led me to a career in environmental law after that.
Charles DeLeva, nice to be here at ELI in their new offices. And I think I can recall that I've had 6 employers over the career that I've had. I started out with the state of Rhode Island. I went to the U.S. Department of Justice after that. And so the state and federal experience I had piqued my curiosity about how environmental treaties could be implemented at the domestic level. So I went to the UN. I worked for the Environment Program in Nairobi. I came back to the Justice Department where, I don't know how many of you know this, the DOJ, where Peter and Leela and Linda have all worked, has always been ranked like one of the best employers in the federal government. They were gave me an opportunity when I came back from UNEP to help look at transboundary environmental litigation issues. But that kind of experience that I had with the UN and working on transboundary issues brought me to the attention of the World Bank, where I then moved to, for the first time, into an international financial institution, and where I've been for most of the last 25 years. I took 3 years away to be the director of the environmental law program for IUCN, which is a hybrid organization between NGOs and states. So it gave me an opportunity to also see how things operate in the NGO side. I mean, all of these jobs have been great. I think what I've really enjoyed about the kind of work that I think all of us do here is, and you can hear it in what everyone is saying, it's so multidisciplinary. When I went to looking at what I did in Rhode Island when I first got exposed working with hydrologists, foresters, and now at the World Bank where I work with anthropologists and economists, the thing about environmental law that has been so such a sense of renewal is that there are always new disciplines coming in that I don't think you get in most other areas of law. And the other aspect about it, I was thinking on the way over here, is that my kids relate to what I do. I think if I had gone into a more sort of corporate type approach, I don't think they would have been as easy to relate to what's happening to their world, what's happening to their climate, what's happening to their water. And that's what makes the environmental field such a dynamic and an interesting field to be in. It's been a great privilege to be in it all these years.
So expanding on Charles' point, I wanted to open it up to the panel if you can chat a little bit about how environmental law differs from other legal specialties for those who are in law school who are still trying to decide what path to go down. And I guess I'll start with Linda.
Oh,
I can call you out.
No, it's you know, I get this question a lot from law students about, like, what is environmental law? Well, environmental law is a really broad field. I mean, it can be air, it can be water, it can be, you know, some folks mix energy into the environmental law, or some people like to keep it very separate. And you can work on sort of security aspects of environmental law. You can work, I mean, it's a really broad field. And to me, a great thing about it is what Charles was saying, that it sort of mixes so many disciplines, and it's very interesting, and you can encounter a lot of different issues. Like, I'm an environmental lawyer, but I constantly deal with administrative law, constitutional law. I mean, like, all these other disciplines of law that you may think are separate actually are not. It's very rare if you're in the environmental regulation field that you're not doing some administrative law issue, right? And constitutional law issues come in there as well. And so I think that's where it's different from other types of law, because it's so multidisciplinary, and that you end up tapping into different types of law that you thought, oh, I'm never going to do criminal law, but there's environmental crime cases, and not in Leo's division, but in other divisions that work on, you know, the criminal side of environmental enforcement and environmental issues. So it really is a really interesting intersection, and that's why I find it interesting myself.
I'll just add a little bit that it also includes a lot of things that you may not anticipate, like transportation law is also considered environmental law as well. So interested in aviation or trains or various types of clean energy that can be used in transportation, that's also, those people consider themselves environmental lawyers in most cases. And you'll see on like state bars, if you look at their websites, and they have like subcategories, environment and transportation are almost always together, which is interesting, and before I came into the field, it would not have occurred to me. I would have thought of them as adversarial and not related, but they aren't. Actually, they're quite related, which is really interesting. And it can be something that there are parts of environmental law that may not feel like initially they would be environmental law. Like if you wanted to work with oil and gas, if you wanted to work with mining, things like that, those are all natural resources issues, and that those are also environmental law. So it's not, you don't only have to be a tree hugger to be an environmental lawyer. There's a lot of opportunity in environmental law. I am a tree hugger, but there are other ways. If you don't want to hug trees with me, you can do other things.
Well, you know, and one of the really interesting things about environmental law, and I think Charles touched on this, is that it's ever evolving. So if you were to just read the Federal Register, which I don't advise you to do every day, but there's going to be a new rule or a proposed rule, or the landscape's going to constantly shift. You know, agencies are always putting out new rules that are applicable and really change the landscape for economic development. And I think that's one thing that really separates environmental law from something like torts, which is more or less, it's always going to be the same. You know, judges may interpret it differently, but an assault, the elements of an assault are going to be the elements of assault, whether you were practicing in the 1800s or today, and that's just, there probably wasn't any environmental law in the 1800s. And another thing to think about is environmental law really, it's a way to balance sustainable development. You know, when you're going to build a brand new manufacturing facility, usually the authorization you need to get in order to construct that building is going to come under maybe the Clean Air Act. Which people may not immediately think that environmental law controls whether or not you can actually build this building or not. So it does. It touches on many aspects of the economy. It's always changing. And then I actually had a law professor who said, to a certain degree, environmental law now is what the civil rights movement was about in the 60s and 70s. So it's also really a way to give people a voice of what happens in their community, and certainly environmental justice components of environmental laws are a way to think about, you know, how does environmental law and community interact.
Great. Well, I do encourage those who are online to submit their questions through GoToWebinar, but I'll turn things over to the room if anybody has the question that they'd like to start off with.
I was just going to ask, apart from the obvious, energy progress and development, what do you guys see as like the next big problem or issue in environmental law? For me personally, it seems like water might be the next big issue. So I was just wondering, from your guys' professional experience, what is the big next problem outside of the usual progress in energy?
Since I am a water wonk, I'll answer that. I happen to agree with you, shockingly. I do think water is the next big thing. I think water has been a kind of a looming slow motion train wreck for a long time, and that train's about to hit the poor pedestrian sitting in the middle of the tracks. I think especially at the state level in the United States, in Western states where water crises are imminent, there's going to be a fair amount of change in the next 5 years with how water is managed at the state level. I happen to think that's a huge opportunity. Now, water laws have need to have been changed for a long time, and politics have kept that from changing. But with crisis comes opportunity, and I think it's an area of ripe opportunity for creative change.
I'd like to supplement what Margaret was saying, in the sense that water also has this huge impact on where most people in the world are moving, which is into the cities. And if you look at most mega cities around the world, they're dealing with either water shortage or they're dealing with sea level rise. And so the relationship there is not only sort of regulating water flow, but the zoning and land use aspects, and how are you going to deal with the fact that you look in a lot of communities around the world where people will have to resettle into host communities, and then you're going to have to find a way for these host communities to share resources, often in places where there may not be other available land. So the physical and the zoning aspect related to the resource shortage or demands, I think, is going to be a major issue. Of course, we didn't say climate, but climate is associated with all of that.
Can I amend based on the discussion we had over lunch, I think a subset of this, if you guys really want to specialize, is law related to how public utilities are managed, both electricity and water. I remember when you played Monopoly, the utilities were the old-fashioned stodgy things. That's finally changing, and rethinking how we manage those public utilities. Public utilities on the electrical side are being incredibly innovative, and there are a fair amount of legal issues associated with that. And water utilities are going to follow behind. We're usually about a decade behind on electricity. So.
And I think I'll also add that the air and electricity issues are also going to be very important, right? I think the driver of our electricity source and fuel sources often come from air law and new regulations and restrictions, right? So maybe an administration says, we're going to shift from coal to natural gas to renewables. I mean, those are going to have tremendous impacts on our economy and the way that the laws are formed. I can't think of anyone that came out recently that's not currently being challenged in court by one side, the other, or both. So I think if you want an idea of the types of laws that are trending or that are going to be important in the future, look at what's being challenged in the courts, because that means somebody's got significant stakes at risk, and they're willing to challenge them before the courts in order to figure out, is this right, is this not right, is this something that an agency can pass, or is this something that the Congress should address? So that's another good source to figure out what's coming in the future.
Great.
I think I just, sorry, one more thing. But this is just giving you an idea of how big environmental law is. I think, personally, I think another big driver in the coming years is going to be public health. The more we move into cities, the more we are all reliant on the same systems and all living near power plants and other things. Public health is going to be a big driver of what laws, what regulations the agencies are going to be forced to enact. They're very reactive. So when there's a health crisis, then, you know, a few years later, like utilities are 10 years behind, the agency's probably about that as well. But the more problems we have with that, the more there's going to be pressure for environmental regulations, particularly with air and water. We have, you know, more people ever in the history of the country with asthma. We have all kinds of concerns with water quality. Those things are going to be ultimately environmental issues. And the crossover there, I don't think, has been completely fleshed out yet, but I think it's going to become more and more important.
And just to follow up on that, is the other side of that of public health is food, mm-hmm. and land resources and law. And there's more and more the issue of looking how we grow our food, how we transport our food, how much food we're wasting, and that all impacts public resources and land use issues, which are all considered environmental law as well. So I've been hearing much more about sort of food law, which really isn't food law, I mean, but it's sort of been encompassed as the term food law, but it's a really interesting intersection of land use law, which includes water and, you know, all sorts of other issues and sort of how we consume and grow and transport food.
Hi, everyone. So I'm personally at a crossroads, and I think many people here could probably relate, where I'm trying to have the most impact that I can through my career. And so I was wondering, how do you leverage your law degree to have the most impact? And what do you think about, as a side question, like having a supplementary sort of master's degree before or, you know, on top of your law degree in order to maybe give you more specialization? And so, yeah.
Oh, I'll go in.
We're all jumping on
questions. And I feel like I may be too old to be able to answer that, because when I got out, there wasn't a field of environmental law. And so I managed to leverage my degree by helping to, you know, build the discipline. Literally, when I went to law school, I went to Harvard, and they refused to have a full-time environmental law professor, and they refused have an environmental program because they thought it was just a subset of administrative law. I think they're on the wrong side of history on that one. But I think from hiring people over the last few years, my view is it's less the degree that you have and or what you're doing with it, and the jobs you have are much more relevant than whether you went back and got a master's degree. So I think a master's degree is less powerful than everyone thinks it is. Mm-hmm. And getting the practical experience out on the ground, either through jobs or through volunteering, if you know you don't have a job or you have not the right job, the beauty of the environmental field is there are a lot of ways you can volunteer in it, as well as working. And one example in my career, when the Berlin Wall fell down, I was very inspired by that and wanted to go over and help in Czechoslovakia. The revolution came out of the environmental community, unlike in Poland where it was the labor community. So I literally quit my job and moved to Prague. I would never have been hired for that job. I didn't speak any Czech. I didn't know anything about the country. I had never worked on international issues. But I quit my job and went over there and worked for a year or so, and managed to be, for a short time, one of the leading experts on environmental issues in Czechoslovakia. That was a short time, but it helped launch my career and my now husband's career. We went together. He teaches international environmental law now, and this was our introduction to it. So taking bold steps, volunteering, I think is much more valuable than going back and getting a master's degree.
I mean, to the question of where do you want to have the most impact or be impactful in your career, it's a hard question to answer, which is why I think the panel was a little silent in the beginning. But to me, it's not necessarily in terms of like a specific area of law, but I personally think that you will be most impactful if you work in a field or in an organization that you care about deeply, that you're passionate about, that you want to continue to learn and grow in. And because you have that passion and you want to grow and you want to make the organization better or make the world better with relation to one specific area you care about, that's where you have the most impact, because that's where you're going to put your energy and your time. And, you know, maybe it'll take you a little bit longer to pay off your law school loans, but what you're doing drives you to be like, I want to keep doing this, and it's okay if I've got to work my finances as another way to sort of make my life, you know, manageable. But to me, the people I see who have the most impact in the work they do, whether it's environmental law or anything that they do, the people who have the most passion about it, either about the work itself or the organization that they're working for. And it's something to think about. And I tell folks who are looking for new jobs, transitioning, it's like, just go read some job descriptions. Or just, if you've heard of an organization that sounds so cool to you, like, research them a little bit. Like, see if they're hiring. Because if something about that sparks your interest, I mean, that's the direction you might want to go in. Right, and in terms of master's degree, I would have to agree. I mean, unless you truly know the specialty you want to be in, like I know that I want to study, you know, water shortage in this part of the country, and I want to do an LLM. That's really, to me, that's, you know, I meet very few young attorneys who know that off the bat. I meet attorneys later on in their career who want to teach in a university and a law school, and then they go back and they get their LLM in a very specific area, and then they use that to sort of transition their way into being a professor of law, right? But for me, and when I interview people at the law firm and other organizations, like the people that have experience and bring that to the table, to me that's much more valuable than having an extra master's degree where you're, you know, doing a lot of sitting in a lecture hall and, you know, learning that way, as opposed to being like really getting down in the dirt and understanding what the law can do.
Yeah, I'll agree with what Linda said. I mean, if you want to practice in the agricultural biotechnology field, it's really good to have a biology degree, because you're going to be dealing with very highly complex issues. Same way, if you want to work on chemicals issues, it'd be great to have a master's degree in chemistry. But outside of that, if you can demonstrate that you're interested in the area, then I think that really gives you a leg up. So my undergraduate degrees were in public policy and economics. But I knew that I wanted to do environmental law. So I went to a law school that had a specific program that gave me kind of a degree and a half. I did environmental moot court. I was on an environmental journal. You know, so when I went into my first interview and they didn't have to ask me, well, you haven't demonstrated an interest in this field, why is it you want to work? Because they can look at your resume and see, whoa, you've done X, Y, and Z, and it's not that you just took environmental courses in law school, but you actually enjoyed it so much that you went outside and took on these kind of extra activities that you didn't have to do, that weren't part of the curriculum. So if you can do, and it may be something as simple as starting your own blog and writing about, you know, cases that fall under one statute or certain environmental issues that you want to follow and you like and you want to, you know, write about it. You can do something that simple. But it's just, you know, do something that you kind of show you're going out of your way and that you have a demonstrated interest in the field. And I think that would be well received by anybody, especially for entry-level positions, because everybody's going to expect you've had very little experience, you know, maybe the exception of somebody who interned at the EPA or an organization or something like that over a summer. But I don't think at the entry level anybody really expects you to have lots of experience. They just want to see that you're interested in the area.
Can I add one or other comment that I think is important to remember? Is there, if you want to have an impact and you think having an impact could be working for an environmental group or for another type of nonprofit, but you're hesitant to do that because you don't want to eat ramen noodles for the rest of your life, I think that's a false assumption. I think you can have a very good career and decent paying career in the environmental community and the nonprofit community. It is no longer that you're not going to have to mortgage your life away. You're not going to have you know, a Porsche, but, you know, you can have a Prius. just keep it in mind. Don't eliminate it for financial reasons.
Well, and even if you're at a big firm, you have the opportunity to do pro bono projects. If that's how you want to spend your time, do your pro bono with environmental organizations. I did that when I was at my former firm and helped out an environmental transportation organization. You can have an impact that way as well.
That's also like I think the premise of your question is fine, but somebody who has to do a lot of interviewing and managing, I think it's useful. And so just to add to that, yeah, I work for an organization that has a good mission statement, right? We're going to end poverty. So a lot of times people will say, well, according to those of you with Porsches and Priuses, it's going okay. But my point, so I think a lot of times people will come out of law school and say, you know, I want to work with you. That's, you know, it's a fantastic mission. But when you get into the structure of the organization, I think is kind of what that Peter and Linda are saying, you need to identify how you can help. You can't sort of look to the somebody who will understand that you're coming from a good place, but expect them to pick out for you where you can be of service in a number of instances. So it's really, you know, if you can say, I know what you do, and this is how I think I can help you, you have a step up from somebody who's saying, I want to do great things. You know, I've committed, I've done great in law school, here I am. So I think that's an important thing for people to really think about. You know, some of it has to come from you as opposed to, you know, those who may even be in a mentoring position.
I think to build just quickly on that point, the final thing I would add that hasn't been said is don't self-select out of opportunities because you think maybe you didn't go to the right school or you might not be good enough or you read the job description and you're like, wow, that sounds cool, I'm not qualified. Like, that's up to them to make that determination. Go for every opportunity that interests you. I went to 2 state schools, and when I applied for the honors program, I was pretty sure I wasn't going to get in, but I knew I would not forgive myself if I didn't try because I was so excited about the possibility. So, and I know a bunch of my peers were like, oh, I didn't apply. There's no way they would pick me, right? Like, let them make that decision. Don't self-select out of anything that interests you, especially if you think it'll align with what you want to do.
Yeah,
that's
great.
That's great.
Great
advice.
Yeah.
Great. Another question?
Cool. Thank you all for being here. We mentioned communities and displacement with water and public health and so forth, and seeing how the intersection with the environment and human rights is becoming more important in regards to environmental justice. Big green groups have kind of been slow to hop aboard that train and kind of approach and tackle these problems, but how is the environmental law kind of community or concept as a whole approaching these problems both domestically and internationally?
At the international level, there is this intersection now, and this is where we're talking about multidisciplinary, between what used to just be seen as the environmental field and now is bringing in a lot of that elements of international law, such as international human rights law. What I think is interesting is the U.S. is really the birthplace of the environmental justice movement, and that movement was able to take place really, I think, without focusing on what sometimes might be seen as political human rights issues. And I think succeeded because of the dogged work of people like Robert Bullard in the South, who were really working through the statutes. So just having good legal skills then enables you to enter into the environmental justice field. But it goes to, you know, the point before about public health. I mean, again, environmental justice is usually linked to public health issues. We're developing new environmental policies now at the World Bank, and one of the things that we did in development, we went to WHO, and we said, if we have projects that are affecting communities, how would you advise us on how we can design projects that take into account human health, community health, disability, it's another area. So I think it's a very exciting field. If you look at what happened, a big case just a few months ago in the Netherlands, where a court said, we're going to tell the government how to how they have to implement climate as far as the, you know, the Dutch government regulatory program is concerned. So it's a really interesting issue where, you know, you have that intersection between environmental, domestic environmental law feeding the international standards and vice versa. So we could probably really support that as a, something to look at.
I mean, I've seen environmental justice and environmental issues intersect through the Clean Air Act, and as Peter was talking earlier, you know, sometimes you want to build a facility or a building, you've got to get the permits, and a lot of them are air permits. And what EPA has been doing over the last more than several years, but it's really trying to integrate environmental justice issues and efforts into the air permitting program and making sure that communities get a chance to review draft permits before they become finalized and petition them if they think that there should be stricter controls or that the review wasn't necessarily as strong as it could be. So there's a lot of areas within EPA regulations where environmental justice is playing a big role. And if you all are familiar with the Clean Power Plan that is currently in litigation now, that in the final rule was the Community Energy Incentive Program, CEIP, I think that's the correct acronym, and that was about ensuring that low-income and economically disadvantaged communities get a chance to have renewable energy and really focus on having some incentives to bring renewable energy to those parts, to those different communities. That wasn't, you didn't have those kind of programs in older EPA regulations, so that really shows how environmental justice being woven into the fabric of sort of, you know, statutory law now, and sort of really the voice is becoming louder, so there's like more pressure, there's more pressure on EPA to sort of make sure all of those are considered in all of their regulations. So I think that's a good positive step forward.
I'll add that I think, you know, some of the most visible efforts of the big green groups historically and maybe even today has been efforts at the national level. And national level policy, even if it's public health focused, which that's the driver of most environmental regulation, new and up and coming, doesn't always square with local issues, right? And the way, you know, Sierra Club's biggest campaign today is focused on coal-fired power plants, and that those are efforts from plant to plant. But we don't see that necessarily, that work on the national stage, as we do with the Clean Power Plan and these other federal regulations. And so, you know, we, and I know other Greens, are making a concerted effort and not just engaging with our chapters at local levels, as we have always done, but with environmental justice groups as well, to understand where, you know, those public health impacts are the most felt. And you can see, you know, the efforts of that work of those groups, along with Sierra Club and others. And, you know, the Front Newsweek's cover a couple months ago was about Detroit, where I'm from, some of the public health impacts there. And so it's certainly something that always looking to improve, but as the panel has noted, you know, environmental justice is increasingly part and parcel with all of the environmental work.
Great. So at this time, do we have any questions from our online audience? Okay, so we'll go back in the room.
Hi. I remember that Mr. Charles, you worked in Nairobi. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experience abroad, and if you have, if all the panelists have any advice for students who want to have a career oriented more on the international scene, and those who want to work abroad, and if you have any insights into that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there's many different ways of doing it. I'm a little bit like Margaret, sort of, for me, it was sight unseen. I had traveled in Kenya before and felt that it was a place I was intrigued by, and it was beautiful, and UNEP was a relatively new organization. So I wrote to them and it succeeded. I don't know whether that would work today. I think that, you know, the typical system of, you know, feeding your resume in we had an internship application system recently. We had 500 applications for one. I think getting to know someone personally at conferences and then following up with an article that you've written that shows an interest, for example, you know, WHO folks that are working on community health, go to WHO when you're, you know, next time you do, you know, you're traveling, or there's, most of these organizations have offices here too. Go to the office of the international organization here, get to try to shake hands with people, establish some connection, and then it will be through people who give you the ideas of how to, when there are openings, or it really, in this world of internet connection, I think it's still very much the personal connections. When I think of every one of the jobs I've had, it's always been something very personal for me that's happened. Whenever I've done things that have been very kind of rote, it just hasn't worked out as well. So, but again, most of the organizations today that are doing international organizations, most of them are very dealing with severe budget cuts. So you look at an organization like UNESCO or WHO, for example, they have fantastic agendas, and agendas that include a lot of environmental law. Like a lot of people, WHO has had environmental law digests for many years. IUCN, where I worked, FAO, these all have fantastic agendas. They're all suffering with budget cuts. And given the humanitarian crisis going on in the world, their donors are cutting back. So you have to find ways to reach out to them that maybe volunteer at the beginning. You know, can I do a volunteer internship program with you? Once you get to know people and you do a good job, things will open up later. But the standard degree of opportunities, I think, is going to be more of a challenge for most international organizations in the future. And the one other thing I need to mention is languages, because most international organizations today, where the jobs are very competitive, if I see somebody who I know, you know, for example, we just had somebody who works on Francophone Africa take another job. So now within my office, I'm scrambling to find somebody who can do Francophone work. If you have that second language, that third language, you're like three employees in one in international organizations. So that's, I think, something, put at the top of your resume, build it up. You know, you don't have to be absolutely proficient in all instances, but if you could show some strong fluency, that really gives you a big leg up in that situation.
I'd underline everything Charles just said, and the other thing I would just reiterate is, I think for those of you in the room, you're in D.C. this summer, huge opportunity. There's so many international organizations that have offices here, not only the international organizations, but nonprofits, corporations, and the rest, and they all have receptions, and crash them. Start networking.
Yeah, another good way to sort of network sort of environmental international law is, for those of you in law school now or recent graduates, you know, the ABA SEER, the Section on Environment, Energy, and Resources, has an international environmental law section. And because I work closely with SEER and I actually help mentor that committee, it's a really big committee with a lot of really committed people who have monthly committee conference calls. They do programs, are constantly looking for volunteers to help write articles or help put together a program. And this is a great way to, the way I like to network, I cannot do cold networking very well. I like to volunteer for organizations, get to know people by working with them. Like, oh, do you need help writing a case summary for that international law case? I'm happy to do it. Would you review it when I'm done with it? And then I'm like exchanging emails with a very seasoned international environmental lawyer who's like reviewing my work. It's like awesome, you know. And then they know me. They're like, oh, I worked with so and so, which is great. She was really responsive and timely. Her work was really great. I mean, that's how your name gets passed around. Mm-hmm. So what I do is, you know, the DC bar has an international section. Any of your state bars will have an international section, and they're constantly begging for help. Like, we need some help to do a program or to help plan a reception, or and if you're able and willing and just want to sort of be working in that area, I highly recommend joining now as a law student, because I think for law students it's free for the ABA. Like, take advantage of it, because it's not free when you graduate. And they give you a little grace period, but it's pretty hefty. And unless you work for a law firm, you're picking up those dues every year, right? And so I just strongly suggest, and that's how I got to know, I met Troubles that way through the DC Bar Committee when I was a young associate at a law firm, where I was like, I don't think I ever would have run into his circle of the World Bank. But because we're on the same committee, we got to know each other. And it's a great way to sort of reach outside of your little circle and to grow your network. And for those of you who don't like sort of receptions where you're just shaking hands, to me, I go the volunteer way. And that's how I sort of have built my network over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years.
For those of you, sorry, very quickly, that are students, there are very few times in your life when you can pick up and move to another country and still be doing what you're doing, and school is one of those times. So if you need language skills, if you just feel like living abroad, take full advantage of your study abroad program. I studied abroad during law school, took classes in Latin America. It was fantastic. And it also helps your resume if they say, if we send you to another country, are you going to freak out and come right back, or are you going to be able to live there? And if you can say, no, I've already lived in another country, like, that's something you don't have to freak out about. I'm going to be able to be stable in a new location, because that happens a lot, right? It's really hard to be very far away from home. So take full advantage of what you have offered to you as a student. You get so many neat opportunities.
Hi, my name's Elizabeth, and I guess my question is more geared toward Linda. I'm an environmental science major, and I wanted to know, you know, if you could do it all over again, would you say that, like, in your undergrad, you would have just gone, like, the law policy route, or would you, do you appreciate the, like, engineering background? And, like, because I'm still an undergrad, so I can, like, still transition to the law policy
still have
side.
Time. To escape.
No, but, I mean, I also don't know if I want to finish the degree in science and then just, you know, potentially do law school and, like, yeah. Yeah,
I got the question a lot when I interviewed for law firm jobs and other law jobs. You know, I don't regret my environmental engineering degree, because when I went to undergrad, I actually thought I was going to be an engineer. Like, I thought about being an attorney for like 1 second during undergrad, and I was like, no, that's totally not for me, right? And so I was happy at the time finishing my degree. So it sounds like you're in this like phase where you're like, eh, I'm not really sure. But I will tell you that it's been extremely helpful to have my environmental engineering degree as an environmental lawyer. When I worked at the law firm or even at the trade association, I'm working in facilities that are building huge things or manufacturing refineries. And it's so great when someone says, oh, this is from our consulting firm. You know, we have to attach this to our permit application. Can you make sure everything, you know, makes sense when we submit it to the EPA, and everyone's like, oh, it has numbers. Linda, you do it. I was like, okay, calm down, attorneys. Like, it's okay, you know. But, like, I wasn't afraid of talking to an engineer, because most big companies will hire a consulting firm to help them with legal issues that all lawyers work with. I'm sure you've worked with consultants and other folks in technical capacities. Having that background to me made me much more comfortable, and I was just like, I can do it. No problem. And being able to read all these huge reports and then sort of synthesize it and then put it back into the law context was a great asset. So having an environmental science background where you're doing law that has some science issues and that's what you care about, I don't think that's a bad thing. If you really don't want to do it, then don't do it. You know what I mean? Like, if you're thinking, I'm kind of glad I didn't have did an undergrad straight in law and policy. I just think it opens up your world a little bit more. And like every single job, every single person who's hired me has said, we're so excited that you have an engineering degree. Every single job, they're like, because it's so helpful. And I'm like, great. So not once have they said, that's a detriment. The only time anyone has ever told me that my engineering degree was a detriment was in law school. And I got my first practice exam back. And my professor was like, were you an engineer in undergrad? I was like, yeah. She's like, I can totally tell. You're like, you just want to write an answer down. You just want to box in an answer. Like, the law is not about that. It's about living in the gray and not always coming up with a perfect answer and being comfortable with that ambiguity in the law. And I was like, oh, this totally sucks for me as an engineer. You know? And I had several professors come up to me. This is, if you track the law students and those who have an English major, a journalism major, a philosophy or public policy major, they have a much easier time transitioning into law school. Any of your hard sciences engineers, when they go to law school, they have a very hard time. And they're like, but you can do it. They were like, don't be discouraged. Like, you can do it. You just have to get your mind in a different mindset. And I'm glad that in my first year, my professor just sat me down and says, your brain works in this way. The law works in this way. And you need to get it together if you're going to make it through law school. And it was a great sort of sit down for me to be like, okay, I do want to do this. I just have to think about it in a different way. Because I've been thinking as an engineer, between undergrad and law school, I had 8 years off working for EPA and EDF. So I was not thinking like a lawyer, but when I met lawyers, I was like, oh, I kind of like these lawyers. I might want to do what they do, and that's how I got myself into law school. But, you know, think about your major, see what you really like about it. Maybe there's a way to specialize your environmental science degree that might capture your interest a little more, but I don't think it will hurt you as an attorney is what I'm trying to say.
I would love if I could highlight everything Linda just said, and I am one of those folks that's on the other side, right? I studied law, environmental law and policy and English in undergrad, and I wish that I had a science degree, and the point I want to make is, but it is not only science that underlies environmental law as a discipline, right? So business, economics, I wish I had one of those degrees too. They're not necessary to what I do, but I will say I started out working on these power issues with utilities and saying, what is a kilowatt hour? You know, what is concentration of market power for monopolies? What is a capital expenditure? And I was able to teach myself, but it would have been nice to have had one of those things underlying. And so it is not a bad thing to be learning something new in law school, because that is the idea.
Okay, yeah. Hi, thank you so much. Kind of shifting back a bit to the international and the networking issues. I'm an undergrad student right now. I'm about to be a senior and graduate, and something that I'm kind of struggling with is finding those spheres for professional networking that are appropriate for undergraduates or appropriate for people that aren't, you know, happy hour related or something when you're not able to attend those type of events. But just, I guess, sometimes it's hard to even know where to start. Like, where do you even find these organizations and these clubs that I believe Linda was talking about, these specific networking events and, like, groups of people to go and mingle with and get to know? Like, where do you even begin to find these opportunities when you're not a law student, when you're not currently in, like, a higher-level program or working at an institution? Thanks.
Sorry, you're saying you're not a student?
I'm an undergrad student, when you're not, for example, in law school or, being referred to these, like, higher level, like, groups of people, where do you even begin to look for, specifically, I guess, like, international, environmental, but almost welcome.
Yeah. So I have one idea. You know, if you are in proximity to a law school or even a master's program in natural resources or environment, you know, one thing you can do is reach out to organizations there. And at the University of Michigan, as part of the Environmental Law Association, we frequently fielded interest and requests from undergraduate students and would invite them to the events we put on and to our meetings. And that was one way for them to ask us about, you know, what we were up to in school and where we were headed. And so that's one avenue, and that is also possible with higher level students in those fields as well. I'm not sure where you're in school, but that might be a possibility.
Yeah, I go to AU.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, American has a great...
They do.
Their law, environmental law program, they have great programs that are open to the whole community, not just... I mean, that's one way. I mean, it is hard when you're not in law school and it's, you know, ABA won't accept someone who's not even a law student
right.
into their organization.
Right.
But you come here to ELI or really networking with the law schools in the there's so many law schools in the D.C. area, you can just throw a stone and hit five of them, right? I mean, between Georgetown and GW and AU and Catholic, and you can go on and on. I mean, within a 10-mile radius, you could hit, like, 20 schools, right? And they're all law schools, and they all do, like, all the student organizations that do environmental law all have programs, sort of like lunch and learns. You know, they do all of that stuff, and that might be the best way into sort of networking and meeting folks who are actually doing this type of work. And all the speakers are always willing to talk to people afterwards and hang out for a little bit. It's a great way to ask some questions and, you know, and really figure out, like, how you can get further. And then they know how to get further involved. Like, oh, you should volunteer for so-and-so or go to the program next week at, you know, at that other organization, and they're just a wealth of information.
Yeah, also the think tanks, like if you Woodrow Wilson Center, Brookings Institute,
great.
Carnegie Endowment, you can just go on and ask to be put on, you know, a mailing list, so when those events come up, they're open generally to the,
yeah.
to the public. Embassies too. We can,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. And just to quickly jump in, there is a website called Link Tank, L-I-N-K Tank, which acts as an aggregate of all these sort of lunch and learns that think tanks in D.C. are hosting. So it's a very quick way to see what's going on right
now. We're all already went down.
That's awesome.
Interesting. I'd be remiss if I wouldn't put in a plug for American University's Law School that has a phenomenal international program. I am a little biased since my husband manages that department at the law school. And Charles is a teacher there.
Yeah.
I named him in the hall last week.
Yeah.
But they have a phenomenal international program that's nationally recognized, and I know it's a different campus, but
right.
Okay. And it's a, you know, go in there, and they have an international legal studies program that has lots of activities, and there's always something going on there.
Can I just comment? I go to AU, and I'm on the Environmental Law Society and the Energy Law Society, so if you ever want to come to AU, and I also love Professor Hunter. So,
Networking in action right here at the ELI event. ELI bringing people together.
And the program is amazing. Professor Hunter is amazing.
You can take my class in September. Development.
As people who potentially like teach at universities, things like that, if an undergrad came to you and was like, hey, I would love to network with you, how responsive and open do you think most higher level professors who work at the World Bank and have other things to do are networking with undergraduates? Like, how responsive?
Depends on the individual. I mean, it's, again, this term chemistry maybe seems trite, but I think it exists. It's also something I say in terms of when you're interviewing for jobs, you know, you can be perfectly prepared, but there's always some element of chemistry, which is why if, you know, if an interview doesn't work out, it's fine. There's going to be something else where there is going to be chemistry. Like sometimes I've gone into a job, I think this is going to be the greatest job in my life, and there's just not the chemistry between the individuals involved, and it doesn't turn out. Other places, you know, as when you're beginning your career, the critical thing is you want to be someplace that's going to foster your growth. And, you know, you've worked all your life to get your degree, to get to this point. You enter into a place. You want to go someplace where they're going to let you be the best you can be. And so that may mean making some sacrifices. Maybe you take a job that, you know, maybe it's not as lucrative, or maybe it's not as convenient. But you're going to have a place that wants you to grow because, you know, you want a career that's going to go for many years. And if you find yourself in a dead end, then you go someplace else. And that's why there are elements of this that are just intangible, where there needs to be faith that the right thing is going to happen in the long run. So preparation, because we were asked, how do you prepare for an interview? Yeah, you prepare so you're not going to feel afterward like, God, the job was about the AIR Act, and gee, I wish I had read the Clean Air Act. Okay, that's you know, you don't want that kind of remorse. But there are going to be things that there are intangibles that go with every career. I'm sure everybody up here has, you know, certain things that happen they never would have predicted. We're probably all in places we didn't know we were going to be. So for that reason, you know, just follow your heart. Sounds trite, but this goes to your question again. You know, what's how you leverage? Well, you know, you leverage your commitment and your heart for what you really want to do, and that's how you wind up in a good place.
I wanted to make two comments about that. One, I think a theme you've been hearing today is enthusiasm and going out and just asking is super important. And I think a lot of people, I know unless I've lost the email, don't turn anyone down who wants to talk to me. And there are a lot of people out there like that. If they're not like that, then they're not useful for your network anyway, so ignore it. Don't take it personally. But two, don't forget that it's a two-way street, and you need to be prepared. It's not just calling up and saying, I know you're an important person to know, can we talk, and can you please tell me what I should be, you know, doing about X. And I've had those meetings where someone's totally passive. They know they're supposed to network, but they got nothing. They haven't done any research, and so you need to do the research. You need to be able to ask an intelligent question about why you want to meet with them. And to Linda's comment, you know, ask if you could volunteer to help with them or whatever, so you can add value to that person. But people remember enthusiasm and well-researched and thoughtful enthusiasm.
Hi, I'm a 2L and entering into my 3L in the fall, so I'm thinking about jobs after graduation now. Because there's certain citizenship limitation with federal government, I couldn't work for them, and I'm currently work for a nonprofit, so I probably not gonna get into a law firm right after graduation. So besides nonprofit or like NGOs, what other organizations should I thinking about applying right now for next year, of course?
So you may need a G4 or visa.
F1, so I'm a student visa, and I'm not American citizen.
So I think, some organizations are used to working with it, and, you know, there's probably some law firms that are used to working with it, and some that simply won't go into that area. You're just going to have to find out in advance. I know in D.C. there are some law firms that have programs for it, and they're used to it, and maybe because they have overseas offices where someone like you, once you come in, they can envision you, based on perhaps your nationality alone, being able to go to that firm's office overseas. I mean, I know Hogan has offices overseas, maybe Peter is familiar. So it's not going to be just your credentials. It's also going to be the legal arrangements that the firms or organizations have. I mean, this is true, I know, in the World Bank, where they have an arrangement with the State Department for dealing with visa processing, depending on the people that are coming in.
And as a quick reminder for those who are online, feel free to continue to submit your questions through GoToWebinar. But I think we'll turn back to the room now.
Hello. Currently, I'm doing a fellowship in an LLM, but I have had experience working in the government, NASA, and state on environmental issues, but I'm thinking more of an NGO route, and I was wondering for the very, like, young hires, if you guys could talk a little bit more about just the career in the government and just NGOs in general, just the atmosphere between both. I'm really interested in environmental justice, so what you can do in both.
I don't mind.
Go ahead.
So I'll take the government one, since I work for the Department of Justice. So your question is basically, like, what's it like to work for the government?
Yeah.
Like, what's my first year been like?
What's your first year and just the process going through? I know the honors program is a very rigorous process, even just looking for fellowships is fun.
Yeah, so, okay. So I'll start with the application process for the honors program, because it's similar for a lot of different government jobs, especially when they're going to hire in batches. So Charles mentioned earlier, like, putting your resume in online sometimes is just like a black hole. You, like, never hear anything, and it's terrible. The government, when it's hiring in batches, is not that scenario. Someone is going to read every single resume. So you're going to at least have eyeballs on your credentials, which is a huge deal, especially when, like, just submitting online feels like it's accomplishing nothing. So it's a real opportunity when you apply to the government, it's not a waste of time by any means. Once you're in, and it is very competitive, right, so I would suggest the way I went about it is when I found out I had an interview, I, like, freaked out immediately and went to the career services people on campus and was like, help me get ready, like, what can I do? And then talking about being prepared to talk to professors, I went to professors with specific questions, and they were, like, just a tremendous team behind me and helped me so much. Like, I don't think I could have gotten a job without their support. So use your resources once you have an interview and put all of your eggs in the basket and do your absolute best.
And then once you're in, so the Environment and Natural Resources Division specifically at DOJ is actually one of the best places to work in the entire federal government. It's the best place to work in the Department of Justice, and I think fourth overall for the entire government. This includes like NASA jet propulsion, where everybody is happy. And it's like, obviously. Sounds pretty cool, I guess. I guess it's pretty awesome. That's a huge deal. And like today for this panel, I'm dressed up, but a big part of it is like the reason it's so great to work there is it's actually very casual. We don't have a dress code. Everyone immediately treated me like a colleague. I came from the West, and so I was a little worried about like, would my transition to the East Coast go okay? Like, is it going to be too fast paced? Are people going to be mean to me? And it's been the opposite. Like, everyone has been welcoming and kind. And at the same time, I have felt a little bit like I got thrown into the deep end. I got cases the day I arrived. Just last week, I learned as I walked into a meeting that I was going to be by myself on a case, but I was absolutely unprepared to do that. So, you know, you get really good experience immediately. And for ENRD specifically, and actually DOJ has a very good reputation in general, but ENRD specifically, it's a fantastic place to work. I've talked to a few people who work at like AUSA offices and things like that, which is obviously still the federal government, and I've heard similar things. The work-life balance is great. People are going to gripe about the pay. That's just the way it is. You're taking a trade-off, right? Like you don't take work home that often. You work a 40-hour work week. You get great government benefits. So you have a trade-off, right? Like you're not going to get some like firm equivalent pay. You're also not going to be working all day on Saturday. So there are definitely some trade-offs, but I am so thrilled with my decision. I'm really happy with where I work.
To be perfectly transparent, it is hard to get attorney jobs at nonprofits. As a general matter, they don't hire very often. As a young attorney just starting out, it is even harder, you know, because they expect the lawyers to hit the ground running and be able to do anything a seasoned attorney can do from day one. They don't necessarily have the resources to invest in training classes of individuals the way you might have at a firm. So it's a different environment in that way. You know, but how can you overcome that, I think, is the question. And, you know, one thing is, and I'll just underscore what Charles said earlier, but in the digital age, it is even more important to have a personal connection. And so a job opens up at a place like Sierra Club, and 500 applications come through online, right? Because it is so easy to apply, and why not? And everyone is perfectly wonderful. So how do you work through them? Yeah. You know, if we recognize a name because they have interned there or come in for an informational interview, and, you know, nonprofit attorneys aren't killing themselves 80 hours a week, and so they have time to do informational interviews and are perfectly happy to do that, and we get a lot of those. And so that is one avenue I would suggest. And then, you know, if an internship or a fellowship is possible, and most of the green groups will entertain fellowships with outside funding, and many of them have their own funding for fellowship periods. So those are good routes. And once you get in the door, and I think this has already been mentioned, the world of people that work in environmental law is very small, and nonprofits is even smaller. There are like 10 people that I work with all the time at other groups, and that's it, you know. And so to show them that you can do it right away, and you have to protect your reputation above all else. But working at the Sierra Club is such a joy. I'm very fortunate to do it. The people are awesome. Everyone is smarter than me, and that is the best place to be.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. And then I would just add maybe something else, like, in general, be patient if you don't get your first choice. I worked with a lot of attorneys who tried to get in through the honors program and took other jobs and then came in as laterals. That's very common. So keep your eye on the prize, and that especially goes with like international opportunities. Take a good job if you get one, and be patient and continue to build your resume. And if you want to make something happen, it will happen. Like if you just keep trying. I've never heard of anyone who said like, oh, I tried for 20 years and it never worked. Like there are no stories like that. If you try something for 20 years, you get it done, right? So just keep trying, like be patient and be willing to take an unexpected opportunity that might get you somewhere even better than you thought.
And I'll add one little opinion on working for the government. it's a good idea to know what you want to do, right? If you don't want to do litigation, the Department of Justice is not going to be the place for you. I mean, I think I started within 3 months of when I started the honors program, they flew me to San Francisco, and I had to defend against a preliminary injunction motion in front of a very ornery, cranky judge, which is great because I wanted to do litigation. I thought, you know, when I applied to law school, that's all attorneys do is they argue things in court, right? My mom was a litigator, so that she colored my whole world of what the law is like. But if you like the environmental aspect of law and you like the government aspect of practicing and litigation isn't for you, look into what the agencies do, right? Mm-hmm. Because many people don't know this, but whenever an agency gets sued, the Department of Justice is their attorney. So the agencies don't generally practice law. They do more of the advising and the counseling and kind of reviewing the work. And so if that's more of your route, then look into what agencies do. So, you know, that really helps in an interview because if you apply to the honors program and they say, welcome, tell us about what you'd like to do, and you're like, oh, I'd really like to help, you know, an agency navigate the environmental review process, and they're going to say, well, we don't really do that. So getting an idea of what you want to do and how you envision your legal career is going to really help you when you get a foot in the door.
And just to underscore that, EPA has its own honors program for attorneys, and the Office of General Counsel, the EPA, and also the Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance, OECA, they have their own set of attorneys. Like, EPA's attorneys coming out of the woodworks. I mean, they're attorneys, there's regional council offices in the 10 different regions, so, you know, like Peter was saying, like, and a lot of the regions now have their attorney honors fellows program. It used to be just in D.C., but now they're spreading throughout all the 10 regions. So it's a great opportunity, and, you know, you don't have to be the mothership in D.C. to work at EPA. You can be one of the – I worked in Region 1 in New England. I mean, the regional offices are great. They're smaller. You get to know people a little bit better. It's a little bit less bureaucracy. But all those offices have regional councils. So, you know, it's another great place to look for sort of federal government attorney jobs.
Yeah, I'd love to add too. You know, I applied to all of these. So transportation has honors program. NOAA has DOE has a new
interior.
Right, interior. Yeah. And so they're
all
a myriad places, right?
Yeah. I'm
currently doing one of fellowships, so yeah.
There's a couple of the types of employers that I don't think we touched on today. DC has a lot of consulting firms that do both international and domestic environment-related work, and they are not always the first thing that lawyers think about, but they can have very interesting work helping clients of the consulting firms develop environmental programs. Another area is the mediation and dispute resolution field, where in a relatively short period of time, I think people can develop a mediation certificate or degree, and that maybe also links with the arbitration field and the fact that a lot of very high visibility environmental disputes over the last 10, 15 years have gone into arbitration and not into the courts. If you look at the NAFTA environmental cases and some of the other bilateral investment treaty disputes, some of the big firms here that you don't necessarily think of as being environmental firms have handled these cases where there have been environmental or health regulations and they've been challenged under investment treaty disputes and have gone to arbitration. So that's another element that, I mean, if I was in law school today enjoying litigation, I might have wanted to do a little bit more on arbitration or mediation, something else to think about.
I'd also add for government work, not to forget about state governments.
Yeah.
Have their environmental agencies, and you know, my friends that have done that have been thrown into the mix right away in a way that even I and maybe we haven't even been thrown in. So
yeah. Or the big cities like D.C. Your District of Columbia has
right.
Environment. Mm-hmm. New York City,
yeah.
Big cities have almost sometimes agencies bigger than the state.
Hi, this is still a question about international practice. I just graduated from law school, and I will work in a law firm this fall. My question is because I am also an international student, and I think my long-term objective is to go back to my home country and practice domestic law over there, not necessarily international law, but domestic law in another country. What do you think about, you know, gaining some experience in the U.S. law kind of use my skills, go back to my home country? Because my understanding is that a lot of things we are talking about today, agency practice or statutes, are very U.S. specific. And I'm not sure how the skills and the knowledge and expertise in the U.S. law will be transferable to a law practice in another country.
It could depend on which country you're talking about. For example, I just worked on a program in the Middle East, and what was relevant to that country in the Middle East were the standards of other countries in the same region. So there, knowing U.S. law wasn't necessarily helpful. But depending on, if you go into the business sector and you're working with transnational corporations and they're doing import-export with the U.S., clearly the U.S. experience is going to be relevant. If you're working in a situation in which you're working on climate as an issue, then you may be able to represent your government better by knowing, for example, what the U.S. Clean Power Plan is, because that drives your ability to advise them on what's the U.S. going to do under the Paris Agreement. Well, I can tell you what I think is going to happen because I know how U.S. air law works, how long it takes to go through the system. In today's world, I think that the ability when you're working with any client to use the internet to look at other potentially relevant sources of information is much broader than when we were operating in a world where there's a very strict line between civil law countries and common law countries. I think that's breaking down, and now it's more what's going to work. So I think your experience here should be on what works, what doesn't work, and most of that is going to translate to any country in the world. Especially, for example, what does the U.S. and Argentina have in common legally? Well, they're both federal systems, so there's a lot of issues about, well, you know, how do you operate in an environmental law when you've got a federal and a state, and then you've got large, urban areas? There's commonality everywhere, so any experience is going to help you. The degree may depend on the kind of partnerships or relationships that exist between your home country and the U.S.
Two observations I have. One is I would focus your networking on your home country and ask some people over there, look, I ultimately want to come back. What should I, what do you think is most important for me to learn here so that you can use that time wisely? And I think Charles's comment is a really good one. Everything is relevant at a different degree. And so to the extent you can look at your experience here through the lens of your home country and really look critically about what's happening here and what's relevant and what isn't, it's all about how you translate it. It's nothing that's going to be directly translatable, but a lot is going to be relevant.
And don't rule out working in-house for a multinational corporation,
right?
Because as Charles kind of mentioned earlier, you could do the work of two employees, right? You're fluent in both the law and language of two different countries. You're going to be looked at as very valuable, and you may be able to work on projects in both locations. So that would be something I think would be really helpful.
Great. I believe we have a question from our online audience, so I'll direct it to the back room.
The first question reads, I'm a PhD student researching the regulatory frameworks in the U.S. and EU governing shale gas and hydraulic fracturing. Their question is, what advice do you have for someone without legal experience to think like a lawyer?
Well, maybe you shouldn't think. maybe that's actually your advantage. I think what's interesting, you're in a field where the law is rapidly evolving, so that's good
for you. I would say that there are international research organizations on carbon capture and storage, on fracking, that you should be able to tap into. And I think what you'll find with your field is that, at least from where I sit in the World Bank, we see many, many countries today struggling to try to come up with regulatory regimes to deal with the with what you're working on. So it's a growth field. So maybe even if you don't want to think like a lawyer, just get a law degree and you'll be able to create a good career for yourself.
Well, and that's one of those phrases that I don't think anybody can really define. So what does it mean to think like a lawyer? For me, that means, okay, here are new regulations and laws, and I have clients. How is that going to impact my client? So for me to think like a lawyer, as I'm looking at it, and then I'm trying to predict, what type of impact is this going to have? Is it going to have a tremendous financial impact? Is it something that's going to be easy to comply with because my clients already comply with it? You know, is it a rule that or a law that's supportable based on the statute that it came out of, or is it constitutional? I mean, so you can look at it from many different ways. And so, you know, when I would advise anybody on how to think like a lawyer, it's instead of just reading something and kind of understanding what the words say, try and get an idea of how it's going to be implemented and what are the impacts of this law going to be once it's on the books.
And there's a second question as well, which reads, how useful are dual degree programs such as a JD/MS degree in environmental law and epidemiology?
And what?
Epidemiology.
Epidemiology.
Well, first, thank you for people out in the ether for listening. second, I think I'm not sure that's the best example of a joint degree. That's a pretty specific one, and I think it may be the exception that proves the rule. I think that sounds like a very specific joint degree, and if you want to go into public health or something, that may be a real powerful, specific second skill. And I think, as we were talking earlier about your chemistry degree, sometimes those specific technical skills are really, really relevant if you know exactly what you want to do. The joint degrees in general environmental policy are the ones that I tend to kind of have my eyes glaze over when I see it on a resume, because I'm not sure it adds a whole lot more other than more student debt. The ones that get me excited, frankly, are the joint business degrees and law degree, because I think more and more business and law are kind of merging together in a lot of tighter ways, certainly from the nonprofit world. In NGOs, there are not many people with business backgrounds and who can talk finance and things like that, and I think that's a real skill. But being able to, you know, cite issues on environmental policy and things that you couldn't just generally get, I wouldn't spend a whole lot of money on those degrees.
And I would say, the only people I know who are attorneys who have an epidemiology background work for EPA in terms of public health regulations, where they have to use the study of the field of epidemiology to figure out where to set certain emission limits or how it affects public health. And having that highly technical background, working with the attorneys there, and also being an attorney, you will be writing regulations. that's part of it. So because obviously EPA has a huge sort of science office, and sort of a lot of people work just on the sciences, and then a lot of people just work on the law. When you've got both, guarantee your name's going to be on every mailing list in the agency to help out when there's a proposed regulation that where public health and epidemiology is in the heart of why they're proposing new regulations.
Setting pesticide.
Pesticides, especially pesticides. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
If that's what you want to do, you've got the right to grant.
Yeah.
I agree with Margaret on that joint MBA and law, for the reason that I think there's going to be a lot of complicated financial transactions in the energy, renewable energy, water supply field going forward. And if the lawyer can understand how to structure transactions, so my background is environmental law, environmental regulation. I work with a lot of lawyers who structure the deal, right? They're deal lawyers. I would like to have known more about that. So I think if I had done some transaction finance, it would have been a nice supplement to environmental law. The other thing is that the biggest risk that most big multinationals and financial institutions take is with large-scale infrastructure investment. So law and engineering, then, mm-hmm. I think, is quite good, because if the lawyer can understand the physical risk from infrastructure, what goes wrong, and then what the liability is or from what goes wrong, then that can also be it. So my history and law degree was probably at the bottom end of the usefulness, but I still enjoy reading Roman history. So. And they built good roads.
That's true. Hi, my name is Robin. I am an undergraduate working towards an environmental science degree. So I'm sort of hitting the chemistry and biology circuit pretty hard right now, but I sort of like it, and I've been doing some environmental health research at my school, but at the university I feel like I'm surrounded by a lot of academic research that's just learning for the sake of learning, like over and over, and I think that I might be more interested in researching something with a more concrete objective, so potentially in law or policy. So I was wondering, in your experience with law and policy, how a scientist might come into the picture.
I actually have a fun story. So I started out undergrad as a physics major, and then they brought in people to talk about their careers who were physics majors, and they all worked in the free electron laser lab, and that was it. And I kind of thought, I'm in the wrong area. And so I started taking public policy and economics courses, and it just struck a chord with me. And it kind of opened up my eyes to lots of different career opportunities. Knowing what I know now, I probably could have found other physics majors that probably went into the legal field, or they did some environmental sciences. But I think when you're an undergrad, you want to pair what you're doing now with what you see yourself doing in the future. And so if you can find a synergy between your current studies and a career opportunity that you would enjoy, then that's great. If you're looking at what you want to do in the future and it doesn't really mesh with what you're doing now, then try exploring other opportunities. I mean, the great part about being an undergrad is you usually can change your major once or twice or maybe even three times and still get out in 4 years. But, it's really hard to know what you want to do when you start college, because you may think you know, and then as you go down that path, things may change. But if you can really tether your education to practical experience and find out that you really enjoy that practical experience, and stick with it.
My comment is, if you are asking that question now, you're 10 steps ahead of the game. In universities, you are being taught by academics, so they naturally, 90% of them like that academic pursuit. What you should try to do is actually in university seek out those that have done stuff outside of their academic world. And there are an increasing number of them in the environmental field. Environment is inherently an interdisciplinary study, and there's a huge amount of practical application for what you're doing. If you can't find it in your school, you can look go to local both agencies and conservation groups and others to say, look, I want to do some research. Is there something relevant I should be doing? Increasingly, universities have these environmental programs that are interdisciplinary to get at just what you are saying, to make sure that the biology and chemistry work is relevant to the outside world, literally. And if you don't have it at your school, maybe look at a different school that's got it. Some of them have some phenomenal ones. So.
I certainly think you shouldn't feel there's anything incompatible between science and law. In fact, building on what you discussed, I think for many others who are like in law school or completing law school, taking some science courses to supplement what they may have done in either business or policy could be a very good supplement in their resume. So for example, if I see a resume and, you know, I was just telling you, infrastructure is a big part of what banks do, and I know somebody understands the impact on wetlands because they took an earth science course, that's a good thing, right? So again, I guess keeping with this theme of the breadth of environment, almost no good experience needs to be hidden. You know, don't put anything. It can all supplement the ability to be a well-rounded environmental lawyer.
And if you know you definitely want to go into law, take a course that requires a lot of writing. Because if you're science heavy, you're probably not going to get that. I mean, I remember switching from physics to public policy. And my exam was to write one 10-page paper supporting affirmative action and one 10-page paper opposing it. And I just kind of thought, like, I've done math and science. Like, one 10-page paper on its own was daunting, let alone two. But then after you take enough of those courses, you're like, oh, 10 pages, that's nothing. And then by the time you get into law school, you know, the 10 pages is your absolute maximum. They don't want any more than that. So it just becomes real easy to just start writing very lengthy things. But yeah, I'd say probably everybody here would agree that we write and write and write. Mm-hmm. And knowing how to write is one of the most important things that we know how to do.
And next to knowing how to write is knowing how to edit. Because you go up in your career, and more importantly, you don't write, you edit. And that's sometimes a very different skill and a really important one.
And then as a maybe like a practical matter to answer your question, there probably, I would say certainly are professors that you already know that have this amazing idea for a research project but don't have the bandwidth, and they would love a volunteer to that they could guide and that you could kind of have some help on direction, and it would already be a fantastic idea. So if you're willing to be free labor for somebody, I'm sure that there are professors who would definitely take you up on that.
To build on Margaret's point, you know, I would seek out the engineering department at your school or business, because there are sustainability programs and demonstration projects that are not purely academic and inform the work that I do and that my colleagues do. And then, you know, if you're looking for internships or examples of places where research is happening that is informing law and policy, there are myriad organizations, and I'm happy to give you a laundry list of them after the session, but many where research into renewables and what is possible across energy and water sector and all that. So a lot happening.
So I think we have a few more questions in the back.
So two more online questions. The first one reads, what advice do you have for someone who previously practiced law but has taken a gap and wishes to transition to environmental policy? This person just completed a master's and they're considered overqualified for many entry-level jobs.
Well, I'm here to show you that there is life after practicing law, although I still am paying, you know, inactive dues for three different jurisdictions. I'm not willing to quite give it up. I think there is a huge use and value to a law degree in environmental policy. I am sympathetic to the you're considered overqualified. In fact, I just helped a friend of mine who has a law degree get a job that she was not going to get because they just dismissed her as being way too overqualified. And I would say, again, show your enthusiasm, reach out and say, no, actually, I really do want this, you know, job, and here are the specific reasons why, and here's why I'm good for this job. The fear of, you know, the dismissal when you're overqualified is a fear that you're going to take this and not be happy or you're going to leave immediately. And so I keep looking at you thinking it's your response. I'm sorry. I'll look at the ether. But I think being able to be specific about why you want that job and say, look, I'm not going to be unhappy there. I know this is different, but this is why I want to do it. And reassure them that you're not going to just take off or complain at being beneath them.
I mean, I also look at, you know, having a law degree and taking a break and then wanting to do policy. A lot of the DC think tanks love people with a JD background, an attorney background, and they want to switch into policy. Any of the trade associations love that. Because I was technically not an attorney anymore, I was a policy director, but I heavily relied on my legal degree to sort of read regulations and draft comments on regulations. So, you know, trade associations, think tanks, you know, all love that attorney background, and you don't have to be an attorney anymore. So I think there are other types of job opportunities and also consulting groups and things like that. So you got to cast a wide net, though, and, you know, just because you might not be overqualified for positions where they want that background and some more expertise as well.
And congressional staffers are great places to go, too. I have a former colleague from the DOJ who left and is now on the staff of a senator. And just,
policy.
And I guess little law, but his law degree, I'm sure, helped him get the job.
Yeah.
And last question online. Does specializing in a specific legal area as new as the environment limit your horizon as a lawyer?
I think I'll actually comment on this one. I asked my career services person that because I did the environmental law certificate program that the University of New Mexico has, and she said, you don't want to do this unless you really want to be an environmental lawyer because otherwise you're not going to get jobs, and I sort of like rolled my eyes and did it anyway. And I had at least three that I can think of opportunities where the feedback when I didn't get the job was, we weren't going to be able to offer you environmental law, so we didn't take you because we thought you would keep us as a stopgap and you would leave immediately, despite the fact that I was really enthusiastic about the opportunities. And so, yes, it can, and it absolutely can. That doesn't mean you can't tailor your resume, right? Like, I could have maybe left off the certificate and not told them that I got the certificate. I mean, you can be honest with your resume, but you can also, like, target the skills that you list. But specializing, unfortunately, can limit your opportunities in a certain way. So I was super surprised by that people would say, oh, no, this is weird that you want to do this other thing someday. And I was like, oh, because I want to do this right now, it's really unfortunate that you won't give me that chance. So, I mean, it is something to be aware of.
And it probably depends on what stage you are in your career. Yeah. So if you spent the last 10 years doing environmental litigation, and all of a sudden you wanted to move to a different practice and do tax law, nobody's going to look at you and say, oh, yeah, you'd be great, because those skills are immediately right. Transferable. I mean, I kind of equate it to being a physician, right? If you're an orthopedist, you're not all of a sudden going to be an ear, nose, and throat practitioner, because that's just not what you spent the last number of years specializing in. So, I think when you narrow your focus into a certain practice area, you may be, and you've done it for a long time, you may be not stuck, but that may be what you do for the rest of your career.
Yeah.
But that's not to say there aren't other opportunities. I just think that they would be limited.
Can I take the opposite conclusion?
Sure.
First of all, it really depends what type of environmental focus you have. If it's very narrow on a very, you know, if you are a toxics lawyer and you want to do something different, you may have narrowed yourself. If you are a litigator, you're a litigator. You can, you know what a motion for summary judgment is, and it's not that different with something else. So I think I wouldn't be too fearful of that. I also am someone who have jumped around. It's within the environmental arena, but I have taken a bunch of different jobs where I had no skills but enthusiasm and basic knowledge, and it's translatable. You know, I ran a program on environmental science, having worked for a decade on water law and policy. And I got that job because of my basic skills. So I do think skills are translatable. You need to be able to articulate what your skills are and how they are translatable, but I wouldn't not take a job for fear it's going to narrow you.
So I was wondering if Peter and Lila could speak from both the government and a firm perspective about whether it's seen as more valuable to have a specialization in one area of environmental law or more of a sort of shallow multidisciplinary understanding of environmental law.
You know, that's a great question, and I think it depends on your personality, right? So at DOJ, at least in the section that I was in, we kind of had command of whatever cases came up primarily under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. So within 2 years, I'd probably say that I was kind of a quasi-expert on NEPA because I've litigated through maybe 20 cases. So you know it in and out. And if that is something that is what you want to do, then that's great. If you're somebody that may peak and get a little bit bored and want to try something else, then it's great to go around. And so I think I took some Fifth Amendment cases, I took some Endangered Species Act cases, and so you can really spread it out. For the government, I think your experience is for your own personal benefit. You're going to continue to get cases in the door whether you want them or not. In private practice, it's great to have a broader range of experience because you're not going to be limited to the statute under which a case was filed. You're going to be, your work is going to be dependent on the needs of your clients. So if they have water, air, waste issues, you're going to need to know water, air, and waste. And in the private sector, the more experience you have with all of that, the more valuable and marketable you become.
I think starting out in a position like with ENRD, where Peter also started out, a general is really helpful because you don't actually, it might be different every year, but I didn't actually know what section I was going to be in. So he works on NEPA. I never work with NEPA. Thank God. But I have a case with every single major environmental statute. So I get to be like master of none, basically, just master of this single case. And then you learn like one tiny provision of the statute and then move on to a new case with a completely new provision of the statute that maybe you get to build on, maybe you don't. So I think generally how to read administrative law. I really didn't think my background in finance would transfer to environmental law at all, and I was worried that it would be a liability, but finance is an administrative law heavy area of the world. The SEC is an administrative agency. So I'd say just having an idea of how to read regulations in general, how they work, how they can be changed, all that good stuff is really valuable. Kind of generally. I don't think there's anything very narrow or specific that I needed to know when I started.
All right. Yeah. So at this time, does anybody else in the room want to ask any questions of our panel? Yeah. All
right. So thank you for sharing.
So my question might be a little bit strange, but I was wondering if you could share throughout your career, did you ever face, not being certain whether your personal values are aligned with the organization or the projects, specific projects you work on, and how did you deal with this situation? Because as I study my undergrad in environmental studies, and I'm very passionate about the idea of development in developing countries, but there is so much of controversial things about it. So I was wondering, like, if you have any advice on how to, explore or being able to still, align your values, but then, still be focused on your work. So, thank you.
I think there's situations where your values may conflict with the values of the place you're working, where you can still grow. And be a good employee, but know that you're going to leave, and not be, and not suffer for it. There's instances where your values may conflict, and when you wake up and you say, "I don't feel good," because this is antithetical to why I've chosen my career. And it's in the latter one where you have to be honest with yourself and your family and just say, life is too short. If it's better for me to leave, I have to make that decision. Because if you stay in situations for too long, it'll color your view of how life does have opportunities to move ahead. And obviously the circumstances change for different people. If you're single, it's one thing. If you have to support a family, it's another. But there will be situations, I'm sure most of us have been in situations, maybe it's just the class you're taking, where there's something about the class that seems to clash with your value. If you grow from it, fine, and recognize that there is, that it, as long as it's finite, fine. But if you're stuck in something that is going to, life is short, and especially at this point in your career, there will be other options, and you don't want to look back and think, why did I spend 5 years in a place where it took me away from what I wanted to achieve? So, you know, everybody's going to face that difficulty. I think hopefully no one has to, but many people will. So it's good you're thinking about it.
I've got three responses to that. First, don't forget the oft-repeated comment that Al Gore talked about with the frog going into water, that if you put a frog in boiling water, it will leap out, but if you put a frog in cold water and turn up the heat, it will boil to death. So sometimes you go into a job and think, oh, I'm comfortable with this. And then you make small compromises along the way. Next thing you know, you go, oh, I'm in the wrong place. So recognize where you are and, you know, where your values are associated with that. Second, it's not just in big corporate law firms, though you may feel that. And in fact, I was in a corporate law firm and felt uncomfortable about some things I had to do, but a lot less uncomfortable than I expected. But then when I went into the nonprofit world, where I was at an organization because I was choosing to be there because of my values, I found that it was more important for me to be perfectly aligned on my values because I was essentially representing myself. So it can happen in many places. And then, of course, I went to work for the Walton Family Foundation, and I had other people's values questioning mine because of the labor implications of the money from Walmart. And then the third piece, to reiterate what I said before, don't compromise your values or don't assume that you have to compromise your values to make a living wage as a lawyer, because you can make a very good wage in government, and you're not going to be a gazillionaire, but you don't have to be a gazillionaire. You can make a very good living wage in the nonprofit world. You know, my husband and I have both been in the nonprofit world and lived very nicely. We're now, he's in academia. I'm not representing myself, but I was in, you know, the foundation world, so it's a little better than nonprofit world, but still, you know, we are making a very good life for ourselves and did not have to take jobs that were really antithetical to our values because of money.
So I guess as we draw to a close, I wanted to open it up to the panel. If you had any last words of advice, maybe not last words, but final words for now of advice to our audience.
I would just say, in the world of the internet, don't just take a template of a resume and a cover letter and have two or three sets of eyes look at your work. Like, at my firm, if there was a typo in the cover letter, it was recycled. I mean, if you don't take the time to have someone else look at it, have yourself look at it a couple times, it's like it's always hard to review work that you've looked at over and over again. It's hard to see the little mistakes. And when you're an attorney, details matter a lot. And if the first time we see you on paper, it does not show that you are detail-oriented, that's going to be a problem. And I cannot tell you how many times I've seen very good resumes that are like, the cover letter wasn't so well written. You know, like someone in career services should have taken a look at it. It's like, use your career services. Do mock interviews. Like, you think you can interview well? Do another mock interview. Professors will do mock interviews with you who've done private practice work or worked in nonprofits. I mean, I did a bunch of those, and I found them immensely helpful with the feedback they gave me. And, you know, you've got 20 minutes to impress someone. You want this job, you have a very short time to do it. Because I can tell you in the federal government and a lot of jobs, it's one job and 500 to 800 applicants. That's what's going on right now in the legal field. The ones that you want, the ones you care about or passionate about and things that you get excited about, everybody wants that job. Everybody wants Joe's job. Like, everybody wants to work at DOJ. Like, thousands of people want this job, so you really need to do the due diligence. And I say this because I've seen some very good candidates not make it through. And I can't fight for them. It's like, I can't, you know? And so you really got to put your best foot forward the very first step. And I cannot impress upon you how important that is. And, you know, making sure that everything is in perfect shape when you submit online, at however way you do it, make sure it's perfect.
And I'm sure you guys have heard this a million times, but this is what I thought you were going to say. And you said, it's an internet world, but please don't live your life on the internet. Like, the first thing I do when I get a new opposing counsel is Google them. And it's unreal what you can find out about people online. Like, please, like, have some, like, boundaries with the internet. You can have as many online friends as you want, and, like, we all live in the social media world, but, like, don't have public accounts. Like, be incredibly careful with that stuff. It's, and I'm sure you guys hear that all the time, but, I mean, it's unreal what you can find out about people online. Like, it's disturbing.
I would add that even in my young 456-day career, I have conducted some interviews, and I just share two things that I really enjoy when I'm interviewing a candidate. One is if they truly understand what it is that either I or my colleagues do, and that might not be fair for us to expect because it can be hard to figure out exactly what a lawyer does within a given organization, but that's something where you need to take a step beyond Googling, take a step beyond looking up their profile potentially on, you know, on a staff page, and in fact try to use your network to figure out what do the lawyers in this office do, because they appreciate an understanding, and that helps you ask intelligent questions and be more engaging and be a purposeful candidate. The other thing is if candidates translate positive experience, you know, translate their strengths from other experiences in their life outside of law school. You know, I know that you know how to write and read from law school, and to Linda's point, don't do anything to make your interviewer doubt that in a resume or a writing sample. But I appreciate someone who appears to see the bigger picture and is translating their experiences from their work elsewhere into their law school positively and you know, attempting to do so in their career positively.
In addition to making sure you don't have a typo, the resume that gets a second look is the one that gets followed up with an email from someone to say, I know this person, and I give them the thumbs up. You know a lot more people than you think you do. Swallow hard and ask.
Yeah. That's the only thing I would say is, you know, I know for many people there may be gaps, that term has come up quite a bit today, where maybe you get out of school and you can't get the ideal job you want, or you can't land something in the environment. When I got out of law school, my first job was at CVS. I think that if you, we're all here because we care about the environment. You don't have to have that big environmental job all the time. If you show that you're doing things that you, where you're engaged and you care about the environment and you're intellectually curious, even if it's just volunteering in that gap period, be proud of that, because that's enough to make a connection with the employer. You don't have to have, you know, the stellar resume, everything there. Just show the commitment
And that will really help you over those periods of time when maybe it's just a matter of luck that something didn't land. So.
Yeah, I'd actually echo what Charles said. Showing the commitment just makes a huge difference. You know, it's one thing when somebody comes in and just says, I like environmental law. Great, well, what part about it? Well, all of it. Well, you know, we're going to need something more. And when you're committed to something, maybe it's a particular statute, maybe it's a cause, maybe it's a volunteer experience, maybe it was a moot court problem or an article that you wrote, when you can come in and speak intelligently about an area and really show that I went the extra mile, I've really looked into this, I know I'm going to like it, because, I mean, sometimes when you work at DOJ, definitely when you work at a firm, you may be up at 3 or 4 in the morning working, and you may work all night. And if it's something that you thought that you were going to like, and it ends up that you don't, it's going to be really difficult to do a good job when you're putting in those long hours.
All right, I guess my brief pitch of advice is that Eli and DC Bar are having a happy hour tonight. If you'd like to join us, we'll be at Laughing Man Tavern starting at 5:30. So I definitely encourage you all to come if you're interested. I wanted to thank you all for coming in person and online joining us today. And let's give a round of applause for our panel.